Hey, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the GeoTrek podcast, where we tell stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. I'm your host, Hurricane Hal. So excited to have you on board for another episode of the podcast. Well, May is Historic Preservation Month. And for that reason, we're bringing on a very special guest. Lisa Craig Hensley is a public policy planning and preservation professional with a lot of experience, really decades of experience dealing with extreme weather and natural disasters everywhere from Annapolis, Maryland, out to her more current work in California and Oregon dealing with wildfire. She's really dealt with it all. And on the podcast, we're going to be talking about really how we can consider historic preservation in light of increasing weather and climate hazards around the country. So you don't want to miss out on this episode. If you're new to the podcast, definitely make sure that you subscribe or follow our podcast so you can make sure to get notifications of the latest podcasts and not miss out on anything that we're doing here on the GeoTrek podcast. Well, without further introduction, I'm going to start this podcast here with Lisa Craig Hensley talking about historic preservation in light of extreme weather and natural disasters. Lisa, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Oh, glad to do it, Hal. Thank you.
Lisa, this is long overdue. You've been one of the guests I've been wanting to bring on for such a long time because your personal and professional life is so multidimensional. I know our listeners are going to absolutely love this episode.
Well, I hope I can contribute to providing them some information and some tools for their disaster response toolkit.
Lisa, so. When I first met you, you were spending a lot of time in Annapolis, Maryland, kind of there in the Eastern Shore. You were dealing with a lot of flood issues and a lot of sea level rise and coastal flooding issues. That was really the context maybe more than 10 years ago. Could you tell us a little bit about that time that you spent there in the Mid-Atlantic states near the Chesapeake Bay and what you were working on?
Sure. At the time, I was working for the city of Annapolis as their chief of historic preservation for their landmark historic district. And right around 2013, there was a report that was issued from the Union of Concerned Scientists that demonstrated that Annapolis had the highest level of sea level rise of any community over a period of about 50 years. And they were projecting that we were had gone from basically 4 days of high tides, sea level rise, to what would be about 2 times a day within the next 30 or so years. So we knew we had an issue that had to be addressed. You know, sailing is the heart of the Annapolis community. It is also the state capital. So there are a lot of tourists that come there. There are a lot of local businesses in that flood-prone area. And, you know, when a business can't open because there's high tide flooding in the morning and they can't provide service, restaurants or retail, that's a big economic hit. And that was the heart of our historic district and our local economy. So it was important for us to try and address this issue by having some type of a sea level rise strategy moving forward.
Well, I remember visiting Annapolis and just how amazingly historic it is. There's so much historic preservation. So all of a sudden, this takes on a different angle, right? It's not just protecting a downtown with business, but areas that have been preserved and restored and just really a vibrant place on the national scale as well.
Yeah, 300 years worth of historic architecture, culture, and a beautiful setting, landscape. So we had to really look at our protection efforts in a way that would incentivize property owners to do the types of improvements to their properties, but as well to work with our local government, our county and our state, all of who had something at stake if they weren't able to control or manage future major tidal flooding events or flooding disasters associated with weather events.
Lisa, I've spent time in a lot of historic communities, and most of these communities are blessed to have a group of people, maybe on a historic commission or something like that, who are just passionate about preserving the history, keeping things the way they were. But then with some of these climate adaptations, things are changing, right? Sea levels are higher. We're seeing more flood days. How do we find that overlap between keeping communities as they were, but then adapting them to, say, heightened flood or other climate hazards?
Yeah, I think this is where you work in partnership. One of the things that we were able to accomplish in developing a cultural resource-based hazard mitigation plan, hazard mitigation plan being something that every community must adopt in order to get that all essential post-disaster funding. And it's updated every 5 years. So we started with a partnership with our emergency management office because they needed to update their hazard mitigation plan. So to your point, the chair of our Historic Preservation Commission, our planning staff, our historical organization, Historic Annapolis, as well as many people in the maritime community, the Chamber of Commerce, the environmental community, the business owners in that downtown area, we all came together. We worked with local, state, and even federal. The U.S. Army Corps was a major partner, providing a lot of free assistance to us to support our efforts. And even, again, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Urban Land Institute, all of them saw Annapolis as an opportunity to work on a model for developing a plan, a strategy to move forward with the types of protections that could be affordable, could be managed by a city or by private property owners. And I think that's what was essential. We did a good 18 months of groundwork to get to the point that everyone was on board with the effort to plan for the future.
So it seems like you really had a highly collaborative environment there where professionals from these different entities were working together on this problem.
Absolutely. You can't do it just as the chief of preservation in a commission in a city. It starts somewhere. So whenever I'm out doing trainings, I always inspire people to be that change maker, to be that catalyst. And so that is the opportunity you have. It doesn't matter whether you're maybe a CEO of the local historical society or you're sitting in a government seat, you can make the difference by starting the conversations and gathering partners around you.
Lisa, we started off our conversation today talking about your time, looking back at your time in Annapolis. Since then, you spent a lot of time in California. So how, and I know you're still having this passion for local engagement, historic preservation. How are some of the hazards you face in California maybe similar or different than what you faced on the Eastern Shore of Maryland?
Well, most of it now, being that I live in the Central Valley of California, it is not so much about coastal flooding, although we do have some of that here. It's really more about flooding due to extreme rain events. And we also, we're looking at more extreme heat events here in California. So the disasters are a little bit different, but a lot of disasters around us and even closer by have been fire related. So obviously everyone is aware of the Southern California, LA area fires, but we have had fires in the Pacific Northwest and the Northern California Central Valley area probably just about every year since before I returned back to California in 2018. So I've actually, during my consulting practice while I've been out here, had the opportunity to work with Oregon Heritage, which is the statewide heritage organization based within the state government that really has been trying to deal with the onslaught of fires in Oregon. So we've developed, worked together to develop a communication strategy to build value into protecting cultural heritage as a disaster, not just a disaster response, but a disaster preparedness effort. What are the places that matter? Why are they important? How do they identify the community's character and why post-disaster they need to be taken into consideration as part of a rebuilding effort?
Lisa, so it sounds like a lot of this effort is identifying what's historically valuable. At some point, like, do the discussions turn to, say, like ways to adapt buildings to be maybe more fireproof, or like, is that in the discussion? Or I'm just kind of curious, because again, when I think back to flooding, I know a lot of my friends are like, we want to keep things as they were, but then we also want to adapt. Do we see the same conversations with wildfire?
Oh, absolutely. I recently had an opportunity to look at a small community in Nevada City, which is in the forested areas around the foothills in California. A lot of those communities exist up and down the Pacific Northwest. Also in the Colorado region, you know, you have these small towns that people more and more are moving to or building second homes in the mountains. You know, we love being in the forested area. That's important to us. It's kind of the environment we want, but it's extremely prone to fire. And I think others are experiencing this issue too, but insurance rates have just shot up for homes that are in these fire prone areas to the point where you pretty much have to have cash to be able to buy a property and live in those communities or have second homes in those communities. But beyond those individuals who own those properties, they're very rich in cultural traditions for Native American peoples. And so we see a place like Nevada City, for example, that has some very historic properties in their downtown area. A couple of firehouses, frankly, which I find ironic, historic firehouses, and they are very fire prone. They are actually doing significant outreach in two ways. One, through a series of nonprofits that are funding some of this work, along with their county government. They're educating people about how to make buildings and sites more fire resistant, the types of materials that you can use. And I think that's the trade-off in preservation. We have to understand that it's more important to protect the asset, the building itself, than to worry too much about the roofing material. You know, the reality is that the last thing you want to have in a replacement roof in a historic property in a fire-prone area is shingles, wood shingles or shakes. You know, going to something that is more fire safe, whether it's going to metal roofs or whether it's going to some type of a treated composition roof, that's the important consideration that you need to have, because those properties do contribute architecturally to a community, but they can't do that if they go up in flames during a major fire.
So, Lisa, could you see a path forward where we're trying to preserve the historic nature, maybe the curbside appeal, what it looks like from the street, even the majority of the structure, but maybe making small adaptations, like you mentioned with a roof? We know that, unfortunately, in wildfires, you can get these glowing embers that can travel on the wind, right? So if your roof isn't fire resistant, it makes it much more vulnerable to burning. Could you see a path forward where we're maybe making small adaptations that can make a big difference for protecting the home, but still trying to keep its historic appeal?
Oh, absolutely. There's toolkits out there. There's information available. Clearing the landscape around the property is the first logical thing to do. Making sure that the vents are sealed to the house so that those sneaky embers don't get in through that. Clearing underneath the property or around porches. Even doing fire wraps, much like the U.S. Forest Service does with a lot of publicly owned lands, whether it's Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife. The fire, in particular, the Forest Service knows how to wrap properties, wrap buildings when a fire may be imminent in order to protect it. And I think that those are all tools that are available to any private property owner who would want to do the same thing to create greater resilience against fire.
So it sounds like there's a list of things that homeowners, actions they can take, which I love, because what you're saying is that really empowers the homeowner, right? They're not just waiting around for a fire to show up. There's a lot of things it sounds like they could do structurally or even just preparing their property in case a wildfire comes.
Yeah, I agree. And it's whether it's fire or it's floodwaters, it really is the property owner that has to make those changes and alterations to their building to protect their investment. You cannot wait for the government to come in. And the last thing you want to do is wait for a disaster to happen and then do something about it. So property owners need to be very proactive and anticipate that it's an investment that they're making that at the end of the day will result in their asset being protected. I think the other thing that communities need to do is there are times, as when I was in Annapolis, that major infrastructure projects need to be considered, whether you raise roads to use that as a barrier for floodwaters into a public space, whether you are developing more along shorelines, you're developing living shorelines to absorb some of the impact of disasters and tidal waves that are coming into the community. There is a public-private partnership. The public entity needs to do what it can, and the private entities need to do the same thing to protect their own properties.
Lisa, I know you have a passion for historic preservation. You and I were talking about how May is National Historic Preservation Month. Why is it so important to have historic preservation in communities? What if someone said, well, who cares? Why should we care about this?
Well, what I think is important about it is the fact that it gives you a place to touch, you know, those places, the history of that community, the unique character and identity of that community is really shaped not only by its architecture, but by the imprint of generations of those residents, the people who have come from elsewhere, who established those communities. Oftentimes communities as my hometown of Lodi that I live in now, were established because of major movements, major historical movements, the rail lines, the railroad coming into California, established our community. And if it wasn't for the railroad and then the associated buildings that developed over time along that rail line to serve the needs of commerce and agriculture, which was what we are, a big ag community, if we didn't have that and we didn't have the associated properties of the periods that over the years developed from our historic downtown to our residential neighborhoods, you wouldn't really know what Lodi was. You wouldn't know who we are or what our character is. And to top it all off, we're surrounded by grape vineyards because that is our agricultural heritage. So it's more about the places that we can still touch that evoke the character of the people who established this place. And people are very proud of their history here. They want their history protected. But the best way we do that is the tangible aspects of that history and making sure that it continues to be viable for the next generation that comes along. So uses can change. I am not an advocate for turning things into museums. I want those places to be living, breathing, contributing components to our local economy and our local
Lisa, history. I love that perspective. It sounds like you're tying together the pieces, you know, both looking back at the past, but considering today kind of the story of places, right? Like where they came from and what their value is, what sets them apart. We have a nation now where there's just more and more cookie cutter subdivisions and big box stores. And you know, if a big box store in Cleveland gets flooded, it looks exactly the same as the one in Seattle, right? You're talking about unique, irreplaceable characteristics of communities that really help tell their story.
Yeah, absolutely. Irreplaceable. And that, there is one story to that point I'd like to share because, you know, fire, flooding is a little easier to recover from. You may lose a property depending on the stage of disaster that has struck a community, but usually it's that first level floor that's really devastated. Let's say it's a commercial building and you can repair that. Fire is another issue. And I've really come to appreciate the total devastation that fire can bring to a community. There's a little community that near where I used to live for a while, I was living up in Oregon, outside of Eugene and Portland as well. But there's a little community called Talent. And that community, along with another historic downtown, Phoenix, were struck by the Alameda Fire about 5 or 6 years ago, I think it was now. And they pretty much lost their downtown, their little historic downtown. There were one or two outlier buildings that didn't burn or weren't damaged so significantly that they could be renovated. However, most of their historic downtown was lost. And one of the women that had a National Register listed landmark building, an old general store that she had using historic tax credits, had rehabilitated for use as a pottery and art studio, which is a wonderful little building. And unfortunately, it just after the Almeida fire was burned to dust. But she had a little garage next door, a 1930s auto repair garage. And because it was made out of cast concrete, it actually could be restored. The shell of the building remained, its form remained, and she wanted to actually return that building to demonstrate the concept of talent strong. We are stronger than this disaster. She had to get the building listed on the National Register in order to do that. And it was an effort for her. It was hard for the State Historic Preservation Office to see what was remaining worthy of listing. But it was a compelling story, and they did list it. And so she has used the tax credits, but more importantly, has used the community support for her effort to rebuild that building, to use it as a community center for art and individuals who wanted to basically look at that property as the foundation for rebuilding. So what Talent is able to do because of that story is use that building to rebuild their town to not look like the cookie cutter type of development that could have occurred, but to use those that building and few remaining buildings as the jumping off point for how they choose to see their community rebuild, what its appearance is, and just kind of echoing what they want to respect of Talent's past as they move forward in the future with that.
Lisa, I love that story. I mean, what a picture of resiliency. There's a few lessons in that. Number one is, you know, you could just be completely disheartened in such a catastrophe like that and give up. I love that they're salvaging what they can and doing what they can, what's within their control. It's a beautiful story. It also gets you thinking as well, when a community loses many of its buildings, the ones that are left are, I mean, you could make an argument they're even more valuable now. You still have this foothold on history that hasn't quite been lost with efforts and vision like this. What a great story of them moving forward, but holding on to what they can from their past.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you have to think about it as the individuals, the families, the businesses, the forefathers and mothers that built that little town are being respected in this way. You know, it's just a piece of history that they can carry forward as the basis for the future residents, the future generations of town.
Lisa, isn't there something too about having your flag in the ground saying we were here a long time ago? I do a lot of documenting hurricanes, and typically along the Florida West Coast, it's a lot of high rises and new development. And on one particular hurricane, I ended up in Apalachicola. I had never been there before, and there was a river, and I ended up setting up, and there was a historic sign with pictures. And it was like, wait, there were barges bringing cotton down these rivers in the 1850s and 60s. I had no idea. I mean, this is a small community with 2,000-3,000 people, but it's been there for almost 200 years. And it just got me thinking, wow, like, thank God we have the historic pictures and these historic plaques and signage, because it was like, this is a special place. This isn't just some new subdivision that went in or a new high rise that's 12 years old. They've been here for a long time. It got me thinking, wow, this is a special place. I want to come back and dig deeper in the history. But you know, some of these stories we're talking about, it's maybe getting that foothold in what was special about this place a long time ago to maybe pique people's interest or really a jumping off point for telling stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Historic telling is critical. I mean, it really is about placemaking. I mean, that's what we do in historic preservation. It really is about the imprint of generations of individuals on a place and the evolution I find it fascinating when I moved back to my community of Lodi, we were all this grape growing. I mean, we, you know, different types of industries or uses occur over hundreds of years in communities. And you can start out, we started out, interestingly enough, as moving from German farmers doing wheat to becoming the watermelon capital of the U.S. for a certain amount of time. And then over the years, we went from table grapes to wine grapes. And so the wine industry is a big deal here in my hometown now. So we evolve in terms of our uses and practices based on the environment that we're in. And I think that that is part of what every resident or every visitor learns about a place. Just as you said, you were visiting a place and you thought, this is really interesting. I want to come back and learn more. And I think that draw is what is so important to not only the people who come to vacation or travel here for visiting family, but a lot of those people make decisions to relocate. This is a community I'd like to move to. This is a community that respects its past, but in a way that makes it accessible to me. And I think that those stories are critical and create some connection between the people who live here now and the people who established these communities in the past. And that's really important. It's something to be proud of. It's something to build on. And then it's a basis for which you would make a reasoned argument as to why we have to protect historic buildings. And it's just good recycling. I mean, you know, it was years and years ago, I learned that historic preservation is the ultimate recycling. So for those interested in the environment, it's a lot smarter and energy efficient and economical to save and rehabilitate an existing building than it is to demolish it and take it to the land.
Lisa, what a fantastic perspective. You're right. You're reusing what was there before. And it's just good for the environment, good for society, economical, good on many, many levels. Lisa, we're going to step out for a moment to do one of our favorite featured moments on the podcast. Then we're going to come back to talking about historic preservation. This is a featured segment called Weathered Wisdom, where we ask guests to share about a weather event that either influenced them tremendously personally or professionally, something that's left a mark on them that they'll always remember. So Lisa, what's your weathered wisdom? What's a weather event that stands out to you that's influenced your life?
You know, it's funny because the one that comes to mind is really my first disaster event. It was a derecho in Annapolis. And I volunteered to work in the call center at the fire department, and well, combined fire police department, down in the basement, which was in a flood zone, by the way. So not a good place to build your or to house your emergency center. But nonetheless, we were okay. I was working the call center, and what I found was fascinating was how unprepared people are for disasters. It's not as if they hadn't had extreme rain events before. It was not as if that they hadn't had regular flooding, but the lack of preparedness. And interestingly enough, if you have a chance to work in a call center, whether you are a government employee or if they take volunteers and you're willing to be trained, I highly recommend that anybody working at the local or county or state level volunteer, get the training and do that, because you find out what the needs of your community are. And really, it comes down to three big issues. I need a generator. And where can I get a generator? These are the kinds of calls I was getting in the middle of the storm. I need somebody to, you know, come down a tree to basically a landscape firm to come down and cut this tree, which is blocking my driveway or has fallen into my house. And then the third one was, is school going to be open tomorrow? I mean, it was just amazing. Their needs aren't really about things we may think of. The things such as fallen lines and potential fire and concerns for public safety, The fire department and the police department are on top of that. They are taking phone calls, they're responding. But the basic needs of people in their homes, protecting their homes, getting access to their homes, repairing their homes, and it's a unique thing. It's something that I will never forget, being able to help people who were desperate to be able to address damage to their property. So that still sticks.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Lisa. Not only did you unfortunately have to endure that extreme weather event, but then you had that social connection, seeing like, what are the questions on people's minds? What are they reaching out with, their requests? What a fascinating insight on that connection there socially in that event.
Yes.
Lisa, I wanted to ask as well, I mean, and that's an example really of doing public service there. I think you've continued to do public service in California. Is that right? Currently in your role right now?
Yeah, I actually am on the city council in my community. I'm also involved with standing up a local preservation organization. We don't have one. We have a historical society, but not a preservation organization. And as a councilwoman, I pushed for, and we have incorporated completing a historic resource survey and creating an inventory in our downtown for the very first time ever. In the city of Lodi, we have 3 National Register properties, but we have never had any form of local designation or any historic survey. So I'm very proud that we have that underway and that we'll be able to take that to the next
level. When you talk about making a historic designation, do you mean listing a property on the National Register for historic places, or are there other designations as well?
In most cities and counties, it's actually the local designation process that has the teeth that can protect a historic resource. National Register listing is primarily honorific. Most people don't understand outside of some type of what we call a Section 106 review process, where there's a federal undertaking, federal permitting, federal funds, federal ownership. That's the only time that a National Register property, for the most part, has the ability to be protected through a federally funded compliance process. But what I would say is at the local level, through zoning designations, through overlays for historic districts, through development of guidelines and historic preservation ordinances, that's the primary tool to protect a locally designated historic property. So that's what I'm trying to accomplish.
That's fantastic, Lisa. Congratulations. And you're bringing all these decades of experience. I know your community is very fortunate to have you on board with that. I wanted to ask another question. So as far as having that framework for designating something as a historically significant building or place, is there a national definition or statewide definition, or is this defined locally on maybe how old a building needs to be or the significance it's had historically? I mean, what are the guidelines and frameworks to get something listed or designated, and how is that determined?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question, Hal, because it really is up to the community. What is it that, you know, you've got the National Register criteria of 50 years or older. Others associated with it, is it significant for a broad pattern of events or an individual? Or is it significant as a site because of its archaeological value? There's different tools you can use there. But at the local level, it really is up to the community. I've worked in communities where if it's older than 30 years, they find it to be considered historic. If it's about the use of the building, culturally significant, for example, we have a Buddhist temple. Culturally significant with that use, that may be the reason more so than the architecture. Was it associated with an early founder of the city or a particular movement? The parks movement in our city is a good example, where we have a number of historic parks established by founders of the community. So it's up to the community and the professionals in those city government offices to make that determination of what criteria will be used to determine a property's historic or cultural
status. Well, and Lisa, that makes sense, because history really is defined, and really the framework for that is local, right? What was the significance on this town or county or community? And it sounds like there's a lot of local influence there on making those decisions. As we're talking about these numbers, I'm realizing, wow, I myself have now become historic, I think, as I get older when we're talking about these numbers. Lisa,
I just turned 50 last year.
Lisa, I wish we could go on and on. I could talk to you all day about this stuff. As we're getting close on our time, I wanted to ask you one last question. What's one last message you'd like to share with our listeners? Maybe one big take-home message to either inspire them or just give perspective on preservation in light of extreme weather and disasters?
Yeah, I think that's a big question, Hal. I've spent 40 years of my life in this field. And the thing that I always want to impress on individuals, and I think this came to light for me in particular in working on the cultural resource plan in Annapolis, is that it only takes one person to start that effort. And people talk about, well, goodness, you know, $400,000 of in-kind and cash support and 32 partnerships with organizations, and after 3.5 years, you finally got your plan in place. That's a lot of work. But, you know, it started with just two of us who thought this is the right thing to do for our community. We need to look at the long term. And I think that that is where preservationists need to focus. What are the long term objectives that we have? What are we trying to accomplish in a way that goes beyond our lifetimes? And where we have this misperception by individuals that historic preservation is about the past, it's absolutely not. It's about the future and basically adapting the past to the future conditions that we're all having to deal with. And so, as I said, and I just want to underscore, one person can be the catalyst for that. And if that one person ends up, such as me, becoming a decision maker in the next place that they live, look at the success you can create if you just keep the attitude of, we can do this together. We can do this, by starting with that one individual, building a group around it. And the next thing you know, you have protected a part of the past that's going to be part of your children's.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Lisa. What an inspiration, because we often feel overwhelmed. What difference can one or two people make? It sounds like you're saying you can make a huge difference by just taking those initiatives to have local impact, and it can grow from there. What an inspirational message, and just really appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing that with our listeners. As we wrap up, Lisa, how can people find you if they want to, if they're saying, I want to involve Lisa in one of our projects, or we want to reach out to her for suggestions or guidance? How can people find you?
Sure. You can contact me directly just via my email. It's real simple. lcraig group@gmail.com. And I am doing little small one-off technical consultant work at this point. My city council job keeps me a little busier than it used to. So, but I am happy to provide guidance, advice, and take on some small projects if people are interested in supporting historic preservation and disaster resilience in their community.
Fantastic, Lisa. I think this is a really inspirational message for our listeners. I'd imagine some folks are going to reach out to you, but really appreciate you taking time to come share all of your wisdom from these decades of working in this field, and then just wrapping things up, giving us some inspirational guidance on how communities can really take some steps to help preserve themselves and in light of future climate and weather hazards. Lisa, thank you so much again for taking time to come in the podcast, and we look forward to following you in your career as it continues to develop.
Thank you, Hal. I appreciate it. Thank you for what you're doing to bring more information to light about this issue.
Lisa, thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast. While I know that this episode will become a fan favorite, we're touching on a lot of really interesting issues here. I don't think we've ever really gone in depth talking about historic preservation on the podcast, but Lisa makes a very strong point of the importance of historic preservation, that you're really telling that story of your community, where you come from, what you value, and what makes you different, that you're not just a cookie cutter subdivision that looks like everywhere else. A couple things stand out to me that we talked about. Number one is the importance of preserving history, but yet using common sense on adaptations. I love that conversation we had about maybe the importance of having fire-resistant roofs in places where we're trying to save historic structures, in places like California or Oregon. Lisa takes a very common sense approach that we want to preserve the integrity of buildings, but we also maybe want to make the roof, for example, fire resistant so they're not catching those fire embers and burning down. I think that we can get so rigid with some historic preservation perspectives that we end up maybe losing entire communities because we're not willing to adapt. I live in Galveston, Texas, a place that has a deep history, and we've had a lot of workshops through time talking about adaptation to flooding. And what I've seen is you get some historic preservation professionals who are not willing to make any concessions, any adaptations. And then you get others saying, hey, we have to make small allowances to change for increasing flooding, or we're just going to lose the entire community. It's a really interesting dialogue. And I really like Lisa's approach of maintaining that historic integrity, but also using some common sense adaptations. I really thought that that was a key point on the podcast. Number two, something I'll take with me for a long time, was Lisa's perspective that it only takes one person to make a huge difference in a community. That's what she's done, really bringing decades of experience to her work as a councilwoman there on city council, really making change and influencing her community just as one person. So wherever you live, if you look around, you're going to find some history and you're going to find historic significance in your community. You can make a difference trying to preserve and really draw attention and education to those things. And again, it only takes one person to start really that movement. And so really good inspiration there from Lisa. And really just great to have you on the podcast, Lisa, with sharing all of these experiences that could be applied not only to flood-prone places and fire-prone places, but really to anywhere that faces threats from extreme weather and natural disasters. Hey, again, if you're new to the podcast, definitely make sure that you follow and subscribe our podcast, like our content, and leave comments as well. We love to have an interactive approach wherever you follow us on social media or listen to your podcast content. We're everywhere. We're the GeoTrek podcast, but we want to really continue to expand our reach. So please follow, like, subscribe, and keep engaged to ensure many more episodes of the GeoTrek podcast in the future. Special thanks to our production team, Jeremiah Long, Seneth Baker, really helping to promote and edit this work. And again, I'm your host, Hurricane Hal. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.